Welcome back to another episode of Better Than I Found It, the podcast, all things college golf. You're listening to Mike McGraw, the men's golf coach at Baylor University. Today on Better Than I Found It, I catch up with former Oklahoma State All-American golfer, Pernilla Lindberg. She's a great, great gal, a wonderful player, and she's also still playing professional golf today on the LPGA Tour. But back in 2018, she won the ANA Inspiration, now known as the Chevron Championship, a major on the women's tour. She takes us back to that time and provides really great details of that victory. We also talk about how a former Alpine skiing champion got to the U.S. to play college golf in the first place. There's also a really good story of how she married her caddy. So really good stories today and from a really, really great gal. I hope you enjoy the listening. Okay, Better Than I Found It. Listeners, let's welcome my guest today on Better Than I Found It, Pernilla Lindberg. Pernilla, you are one of my favorite players I never got to coach, but I did recruit. I just want to say thanks, and we'll talk about that in a minute, but thanks for coming on and spending some time with me today.
Thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I said that I didn't coach you. I did for a week. So one solid week I got to coach you, and then I became the men's golf coach at Oklahoma State. So we will talk about that in a minute. But most people know you as like a former Oklahoma State All-American. They know you as a longtime member of the LPGA. They know you and introduce you as a major champion. So all of that is sort of your identity as an athlete. But I think a lot of people would be interested to know you were actually an Alpine skiing champion when you were younger, and that's part of the reason, and we'll talk about recruiting in a minute, part of the reason I thought that must be a good player. She's a great athlete. Talk about your life in alpine skiing first.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it all goes back to where I grew up, the small town about 3 hours north of Stockholm in Sweden. So the golf season is very short. My home course has not opened yet this year. And when we're speaking, it's mid-May. They're saying the course is still too wet, so probably still 10 days or a couple of weeks away. So, you know, that's what I grew up with. So golf and skiing were the two perfect sports to combine growing up. I would ski from probably about end of October until end of April. Then I would pick up my golf clubs beginning of May. And the reason I got into golf was because my parents, it's what they did in the summer. And my dad was a high-level amateur player. But yeah, the skiing, you know, if you asked me when I was really little what I wanted to do when I grew up, I said I want to be a professional skier or a professional golfer. Those, you know, they were my two passions. And I did them both for as long as I could. And they were, like I said, the perfect sports to combine. I felt like a very different athlete doing the two. Skiing really scared me, but in a kind of adrenaline rush way, I was so nervous. So playing golf, I was never that nervous as with skiing, which thankfully. So I think, you know, that probably helped too. It kind of took the edge off from golf. I never felt the same kind of nerves. But and then a lot of golf coaches told me when I was younger that I had, you know, skiing to thank for my strong legs and kind of strong base in my golf swing. But yeah, when I was probably about 13, I didn't know if it was golf I wanted to go for or skiing. And then my golf started to go better and better. I got selected for the national team in Sweden. So we started to travel a little bit earlier in the spring to south of Europe to some amateur and junior events. And that kind of started to cut into the ski season. And that's when I decided, okay, golf is what I want to do. And I put the skis to the side. And my parents were very happy. My mom was always scared that I was going to hurt myself skiing. And actually my last ever race that I did, I knew I was going to Italy the following week for my first ever international golf tournament, and it was the Swedish Junior Championships, and I watched the number one ranked junior girl in Sweden crash right in front of me and break both her legs. And I went to the tournament, to the racing organization, I handed them my bib, and I said, nope, I'm done.
That's how you retired, huh?
That's how I stepped away from it.
Well, you know, you mentioned that you never had the nerves in golf that you had in skiing because skiing was so dangerous. Ricky Fowler always told me that the biking, the BMX racing,
he hurt himself when he was young, for sure, and he quit because he got hurt. He said, gosh, hitting a six iron was no big deal when you're talking about making these flips and jumps. So I bet it was very similar.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think so too. And, you know, I always said, so I was better. I did all the different disciplines within alpine skiing, everything from slalom, giant slalom, super G, and downhill. And I was always better at slalom and giant slalom, which was more technical. And how I describe it, I said, I don't know if I was brave enough or stupid enough to be really good at downhill, because I think you need a little bit of both.
Wow. Well, I've never done either. In fact, my wife loves skiing. And when Pam and I got married, I never took her skiing because I hated it. I just thought it would, for sure, I'm going to go down, I'm going to hit a tree and I'm out. I'm done. So I never did. Oh, well. And she
yeah,
quit skiing.
Saying that now, I mean, I loved it growing up. It's for sure something I probably want to get into again when I put my golf clubs away, but I haven't skied for about 10 years now, just for that reason. I'm scared of hurting myself.
Yeah, it would happen. It would probably happen more than I think. One year Phil Mickelson missed the Masters because he was on a ski trip over spring break and he didn't get to play in the Masters that one year. So anyway, so that's your alpine skiing. I think in recruiting you, I never did ask you the whole story. I just knew you were a really, really good skier. And when I got the job, I got it in August of 2005. And so pardon me, 2004. I got it. Yeah, 2004 is when I got the women's job. And I didn't know what to do. I didn't have any recruits to sign that fall. I didn't have anybody. And I went on the internet and I found the Swedish National Federation's Svenska Golfförbundet, right?
Very good.
Thank you. And I got on there and I saw these names of these players that were on the national team. And I thought, I wonder if they've signed with anybody. I wonder. Anyway, so yours was one of them. And I saw you're one of the better players. And Karin Schinnerud was one. And so I sent emails and it kind of started from there. And before I knew it, you two were on a visit. And, you know, and it's interesting and ironic that I would end up at Baylor, because Baylor was recruiting Karin very heavily. And I don't even remember having a recruiting battle. I don't think we did, but I just remember the two of you said yes. And the other girl we brought in was Amanda Johnson from Tulsa. And the only reason her resume showed up on my desk and it said she was a cheerleader and a cross country runner and won the state championship in golf. And I thought, that's got to be a pretty good golfer. And the three of you were my first class. I mean, I wouldn't call it true recruiting. It was just pure dumb luck.
Yeah, that's, I mean, just good timing, I think. I mean, it's probably even more so nowadays, but obviously a lot of younger American golfers, they you know, commit to schools really early. But me and probably fellow Swedes, you know, for us, it's a big move, and we don't really know the college system. So I hadn't started my recruiting process that early. So yeah, this was my senior year in high school in Sweden, and I for sure knew I wanted to go to the U.S. I played, you know, good. I wasn't the top ranked Swede. We had a lot of good Swedes my age there, but I for sure talked to a few different schools. I ended up coming on three different recruiting trips. Oklahoma State was my first stop. My brother came with me and we drove down to LSU.
Mm-hmm.
Went there for my second trip. And then probably a month later or so, I flew over to U of A. So those are my, you know, three very different schools. But I'm pretty sure that as soon as I saw Karsten Creek, I knew where I was going. That was
I thought you would have said tool. As soon as you met me that you, but it was Karsten Creek. Okay, you had your chance. You know, I remember eating lunch with you at Karsten Creek on that visit and thinking to myself, man, this is a pretty impressive girl. We need to make this work. I didn't know how I would possibly do it. I really had no idea, honestly. And it occurred to me at that time, I didn't know much about recruiting women. I mean, I didn't, because it was my first go around. I didn't know what they thought would be important. I didn't know. So let's talk really quick about what, other than Karsten Creek and the facility, was there anything else that jumped out at you?
You know, I think when you make that big of a move halfway across the world, I was pretty serious about doing it for my golf's sake. So yeah, practice facilities, golf was absolutely number one. But the other couple of things that stood out was, obviously you had had a lot of Swedes at Oklahoma State. They all spoke so highly about all of you, the town, and everything about the program. So that absolutely helped. But then the one thing that for me stood out at the time was you didn't have many team practices. It was very individual. You had the trust in your players that they were going to, you know, do the work that was needed. And that really spoke to me because growing up in Sweden, you know, golf is an individual sport the whole way. We don't play necessarily as a team in high school or anything. And I was always driven and willing to put in the work. So I liked that aspect of it. I knew I could go out and work on whatever I needed to work on each and every day.
I'm glad you said that. I still do that at Baylor now. And sometimes you got to be careful. Some kids aren't ready for that. And if they're not, you step in as a coach and help them kind of learn how to work at golf. But I knew you were obviously very good. And I didn't know that speaking that language to you, which was, hey, you're going to work on your game the way you want. I didn't know it would mean that much. I'm glad to hear it did. You obviously worked very, very well. But so you come over in August of 2005 for your freshman year. And we're not having qualifying yet. We're just going to kind of get to know each other. And literally a week later, Mike Holder called a meeting and it was both teams together. And that was to announce me as the men's golf coach. And you girls were without a coach. So how did that feel? And how did you all overcome that? Because initially we didn't tell you who we were going to hire. We didn't know. How did that feel initially?
Yeah, I think there was obviously a lot of uncertainty and it's actually a story that I tell a lot of people. I don't know if Coach Holder will necessarily appreciate the story, but
that's
it just
okay.
shows how much he cares about the program. But yeah, I remember that team meeting with both the men's and the women's team a lot. And as I said, you have had a lot of Swedish players before me, especially on the men's side. So I've heard all these stories about this legendary Coach Holder. And how tough he is, how hard he is. And I can see him in front of us, started crying.
Yes, I remember that.
I said, this is the Coach Holder I've heard all these stories about. But obviously it just showed how much he cared about the program and, you know, stepping away and handing it over to you. But like I said, I think I came in being mature enough that I knew what I was there for. I felt like I had all the help that I needed academically, and just the girls amongst ourselves, we kind of came together and did what we needed to do, even though we didn't know when we were going to get a new head coach or who it was going to be. So, you know, I think it could have been a lot more drama, but it really wasn't. And I think just having all of you in the coaching staff, I mean, still there for us, really helped.
Well, okay, that's good. I've never really talked to anybody about that. And honestly, Mike was emotional because he was handing over his baby to somebody else. But he was also emotional because he talked about Laban Harris that day, his coach at Oklahoma State. And I think he started thinking about the circle of life and all of that. And it kind of got to him. I actually like the fact he did that because so many people think he has such a hard outer shell. And there's some sensitivity in there. And he showed it that day. And I would think you girls would remember that. But I hadn't thought about it from your perspective. You're a 19-year-old freshman and this tough, tough, you know, legendary coach starts crying on the first day you met him. Wow. Okay.
Yeah. Well, so I did get to see a little bit of the harder side from him later on. And that's actually just because I remember it now. That's it was early on in that fall. We were about to leave for our first tournament and, you know, as always, he was down in the gym working out at the same time as us early in the mornings. And he came over to me and said, Pernilla, you're leaving for your first tournament. Are you going to go win it? And me being Swedish, you know, my mentality said, sure, coach, you know, I'm going to try my best. And you can just imagine what he answered to that. He said, try? That's not good enough. And then, you know, from then on, every time he would come over to me and ask, Pernilla, are you going to go and win this tournament? My mentality just switched and said, of course, coach, I'm going to go win this. And that was, you know, something I just learned quickly and just something in just that different mentality of kind of American sports versus kind of growing up in Sweden, and that's something that's for sure stuck with me.
Anyway, good memories, good times. But you played 4 years. You did very, very well. And I think when I think of an American just going 200 or 300 miles to college and getting the experience and all that, that's something. But you literally came halfway around the world. So it had to change you a little bit. It had to be a shock to your system a little bit. Although I think international players are pretty mature when they get to the United States because they may be a year older and maybe they've been on their own a little bit. But how did playing college golf help you develop as a person, personally, and then also your golf game?
Oh, I've many times said that if it wasn't for my college golf experience, I don't think where or I know I wouldn't be where I am today. Playing college golf is such a good school. It's for me, it was learning a new language, getting used to a new culture, living in a new country, playing golf courses that are very different, traveling to different parts of the country, which prepared me for tour life, playing against girls that I then ended up playing against when I turned pro out on tour as well. That's kind of the golf side of it. But then also being just a student athlete in general, learning the time management, getting up for those early workouts, which later on didn't make me scared to work out during tournament weeks on tour. I wasn't scared of being sore because while playing, because that's what we did during qualifying, and all those different bits. I always said too, I feel like we were very lucky at Oklahoma State, being kind of in the middle of the country. We traveled a lot to both the East Coast and the West Coast. And I didn't realize at the time how fortunate I was to get to play so many different types of golf courses, which for sure prepared me for tour life as well.
I love it when a former college player who's playing professionally or not playing professional, but either way, they talk about how it did prepare them for a life in professional golf. I think the tour, both tours, all the tours basically are full of a lot of college kids that came over and got the experience or grew up here and got the experience. It's great. What was your best score at Carston Creek?
I probably not much lower than a 68. I
Yeah.
had a tough time breaking that 68.
Well, I was telling somebody the other day, Charles Howell III, it was his junior year before he broke 70. Junior year. And he never shot high scores. I mean, he's a great player, but he just couldn't bust 70 until his junior year. Once he did it, though, he came out firing. But it's a hard golf course. Everyone's journey is just a little bit different. Yours has been a little different. You've had some highs and lows, obviously, like anybody else would. But talk about your early struggles and how you were able to persevere. Because you had a 6 or 7 year stretch where you were really, really solid. And we're going to talk about a major championship you won. But how'd you get through the early struggles?
I've always focused on processes and doing what's in my control and kind of taking small steps at a time. And that's kind of how it felt. I came out of graduated from Oklahoma State, played that summer on what was called the Futures Tour at the time, now the Epson Tour. Played good enough to get into final stage of Q school for the LPGA Tour and made it through on my first try. So 2010 was my rookie year on tour, and that year I top 100 keeps their card on the LPGA Tour. I finished 103, went back to Q school, but still feel every year feeling that I got better and learned something new. So I that was my second year in a row back to Q school. Earned my full card again and not been back since. And each and every year I would finish a little bit higher on the money list. Maybe the following year was in the 80s, the following year was in the 60s. And that's kind of how I looked, I have looked at my whole career, taking those kind of small steps at a time, but really always having the belief that I'm getting better and that I'm learning. I always also had the belief that everyone's path can look very different. You have girls coming out or guys coming out winning in their first year on tour. But I always felt like I was in it for the long run. I might not come out and peak right at the start, but I'm learning and improving, and slowly I'm gonna get there. And I think you see that a lot from just going back to kind of Growing up, where golf was something I just did in the summer, being a more all-round athlete, that yeah, Swedes might not come out and be world top players in our early 20s. I think our careers might have a little bit of a slower path, but a longer, steadier path instead.
Have you ever had an injury, by the way, during your career, a major injury?
Knock on wood, I
Oh.
haven't. This is my 14th year on tour, and nope, no injuries so far.
Fantastic. Keep it that way. I just knocked on this desk that I'm sitting at here for you.
Thank you.
Annika Sorenstam, have you had much opportunity to spend time with her? I consider her one of my favorite athletes, just the way, the graceful way she's handled being amazing. And she's still in the game and still promoting the game a lot. Talk about your relationship with her.
She just stepped away from the game as I turned professional, and in her kind of transition there away from the game, she didn't obviously kind of probably knew exactly what she wanted to do. So she did a little bit of mentoring for some younger players right when she stepped away from the game, and that was when I was turning pro. So I remember sitting down with her a couple of months after I graduated from Oklahoma State, and she was just sitting there as an open book, ask her any questions about tour life. And I remember it ended up being a lot about the transition to working with a professional caddy, how to work with a caddy. And then so she arranged for me a talk with her long-term caddy, and he helped me find my first caddy on tour. Right there in the transition, she for sure helped a little bit. And then we both live in Orlando, so our paths cross every now and then. Obviously, growing up, I think the main thing was just seeing, for a lot of us younger Swedes at the time, she came out of Sweden and she's been able to do this. So that just proves that we can do this too. And unfortunately, I think just with the coverage of women's golf growing up, I didn't get to watch that much, many of her wins. And just with time difference too, it was just kind of waking up on another Monday morning where it was like, oh, Annika won again last night. And I don't think it's until I came out on tour and know how hard it is to win on tour that you go back and see her records and how impressive it was.
Tiger-esque, that's what it was. I mean, she was that dominant, and to step away from the game when you're still a dominant player, that's hard to do. But what's been interesting and fun to watch is watch her be a mother and a wife. I mean, because she's been still in the spotlight in a way. I mean, have you enjoyed that? I'm sure.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's impressive to see to be able to step away from the game when you are still that competitive. But she had her priorities and knew what next in her life was going to be, and that was being a mother and starting a family. And those are the decisions that you don't have to see as much on the men's side. But Lorena Ochoa was another example. She stepped away. My rookie year on tour, she stepped away. She was world number one, and her next priority was to start a family. So unfortunately, those are decisions that has to be made on the women's side, but I think it's really impressive and kind of brave to be able to do that as well.
And I think it takes a lot of self-confidence and belief to step away when you know you're the best. I mean, it's pretty impressive. So you mentioned your first caddy that Annika actually introduced you to, Daniel. Which caddy number was he? Your current husband.
So he was there right from the start. We actually, the first time we met was at Q School at the end of 2009. Actually Q School for the Ladies European Tour. We met in the gym over in Spain, started talking, and then we got paired together in the last round, the player that he was caddying for. And he had played college golf. He grew up in England, but had played college golf over here in the US too, graduated just a year before me. And he knew he didn't want to turn professional, but a good chance for him, a good opportunity to still stay in the US and be involved with the game of golf was caddying. And he got an opportunity out on the LPGA tour the year before I joined the tour. So his probably initial question was, do you have a caddy lined up for your rookie year on tour? And I said, no, not yet. I'm going to keep you in mind. But I took Annika's advice and went with this other caddy instead. But it all worked out good in the end. But yeah, so we Daniel and myself started dating my first year on tour, and then it was probably my second year on tour. Whenever I would go to Europe and play some smaller ladies European tour events, you know, start of my career, I wasn't going to fly my American caddy over there. It was just not financially viable. So if Daniel had the week off, I would kind of say, "Hey, how about you come caddy for me, keep me company? If we make some money, I'll pay you. Otherwise, I'll make sure I keep cover your expenses at least." So that's kind of, you know, we got to travel together that way. He did a few events for me here and there. I played really good every time that he caddied for me. So starting in 2012, then we said, okay, let's try to do this full time. And we have pretty much done it nonstop since 2012. And with spending that much time together, we still decided to get engaged in 2016 and married in 2019. So we moved slowly, but we've spent, you know, more time together than most couples.
I think it's the most unusual player caddy story in golf, period, but a really cool one. So I just wanted to make sure. So that started way back in your rookie year. I mean, that's a long time
yeah,
ago.
Yeah, exactly.
So you mentioned ups and downs, but you saw a great trend in your money list ranking went up, up, up. I mean, literally to where finally in 2018, you had your highest ranking on the money list, 29th that year. But that's 5 years ago and a really, really big moment in your career. You won the 2018 ANA Inspiration, which is now the Chevron, a major on the LPGA Tour. I need to hear all about that week. My wife, Pam, and I watched it on TV, but I've never heard you talk about it.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, so like we kind of talked about, I'd been getting better and better for each and every year. I would say 2017 was a little bit of a dip. I didn't play as good. But saying that, I got some great opportunities in the late of 2017 season. I managed to kind of be the last player to get into our tour championship, and ended up finishing fourth at the tour championship in 2017. And the only reason I'm kind of starting off there is when I was in contention that Sunday afternoon at the tour championship in 2017, that was the first time that I felt kind of comfortable in contention on a Sunday afternoon. And if it wasn't for that experience then, I don't think I would have been able to do what I did, you know, 4 months later at the first major of the 2018 season. So I felt really good about my game at the start of that week. But if I go back 2 weeks earlier, I almost finished dead last in Phoenix after 2 days, missed the cuts, but I don't know how many. Spent 2 days on the driving range from morning till night that weekend when I missed the cut in Phoenix, just trying to find something with my coach who was there from Sweden. And we kind of just said, okay, let's just find one ball flight that works. I did everything I could to just find this little draw. And, you know, the following week I played in Southern California at the Kia Classic. Things started to feel better and better, kind of trending for each and every day. And then I remember asking him, I said, okay, I have this consistent little steady draw now, but how am I even going to get to a right pin? And he said, oh, you know, don't worry about it. He said, just hit it to the middle of the green on those holes, and we'll go from there. He said, at least
you're
you have
genius.
Something. He said, at least you have something you can trust right now. And so felt really good about the game early in the week. And sometimes when you feel really good on a Monday, Tuesday, kind of your expectations tend to kind of go up with that, or at least for me. And that's not always the best thing on tour. So I think Wednesday, the pro-am, probably didn't hit it as good. And that was probably a good thing because then the expectations kind of came back down a little bit. But then went out and shot a 7-under the first day on Thursday. I was out in the last group at 2 o'clock. And I had that week, you know, I've tried this many times, but that week it really just clicked for me where every day I went out with a number in my mind. So the first day, I'm like, it's a major championship, 2-under is my number. And, you know, that's, I'm probably not going to be leading, but I would, 2-under is a good steady start to the tournament. So when I got to 2-under in that first round, then I'm like, nah, keep pushing. Let's try to get to 4-under. And then I get to 4-under. I'm like, oh, I like even numbers. Let's try to get to 6-under instead.
Wow.
And then, yeah, I ended up shooting 7 under that first day. And then, so sleeping on the lead, but at least I was out late. So early tee time the next day. And I felt so good with my putter in my hand. Pretty much up until that point in my career, putting had always been the strength. My career on tour, I would say, probably not my first few years, but I started to work with a putting coach in about 2011, and since then I'd relied a lot on my putting. But then it was always something about that Dyna Shore course in Palm Springs too. Even before I won, I'd always said it was one of my favorite courses on tour. It just fit my eye. The fairways are quite narrow, and I just seemed to hit it straighter there than any other week of the year. It just kind of really made me focus. I love the greens. I love the grass. So I'd had a lot of kind of top 20, 20, 25 finishes there before. And yeah, I was hitting it good. And then you need a little bit of those kind of momentum keepers. You know, I chipped in probably twice in the first 3 days, just rolled the putts so well. So I got to sleep on the lead on Thursday night. I got to sleep on the lead on Friday night. I got to sleep on the lead Saturday night. And the good thing is, like kind of everything else in my career, I felt like I was learning each and every day. I was getting more and more comfortable sleeping on the lead. So of course I was nervous. I went out on Sunday with I was my number in my mind was minus 16. I was teeing off at I was starting at minus 14, 2 under that day, because all the kind of big names behind me were at minus 10, 4 shots behind me. So I know if they go out and shoot 6 under, yeah, I'll give it to them. That's a good day. They will get to 16 under. But I think if I can get to 16, that will be the number I need. I go out, I make a bogey on number one and number three, and I did it because I was nervous. I could feel it. And so I had such a good little self talk going from the third green to the fourth tee, where I said, okay, all I need to do the rest of the day is make 4 birdies. I'm playing so good. I've made at least 4 birdies every day, so I don't need to do anything special. But just make sure that your nerves doesn't stop you from this opportunity. Like, I put myself in this situation, which doesn't happen very often. Right now, the only thing that's actually hindering me is myself. So, and you know, professional golfers, we have little talks to ourselves all the time. Most of the time, we don't listen, but that day, I really listened to myself, and I, you know, started to play better, made a few birdies, but I stood on the 18th tee, even par for the day, 14 under. I still had not looked at any scoreboards. So 18, par 5, not normally reachable, but it was playing a lot into the wind. So 3 shot hole that day. And I laid up and hit the pitching wedge into about 3 feet, made that for birdie to what turned out was getting into a playoff. Daniel, he knew what I needed to do. And I mean, that's great. Caddy can kind of steer you. But for me, I just felt like I'm gonna go. I'm trying to play my best down the stretch here. I don't need to know exactly what I need to do, but I needed that birdie to get to 15 under. So my prediction was right. If I had gotten to 16, that would have gotten the job done. And yeah, it turned out it was three of us in a playoff. Myself, Jennifer Song, and Imbi Park. And Jennifer gets knocked out on, I think it's after 2 playoff holes. So we keep playing 18 over and over. And Imbi and myself, we ended up playing 4 holes on that Sunday night, the fourth one being extremely dark. They asked us actually after 3 playoff holes if we wanted to play one more. And I think we were both so in the moment, both wanting to win it right there and then, that we said, yes, of course. Not thinking so much about that. This is Palm Springs. The sun, when it goes behind the mountains, it gets dark quickly. And also, it's a par 5. So by the time we're back, you know, back to the tee, hit a drive, hit a layup, it was really dark. So I've said it many times after that I'm very glad that neither one of us kind of won it or lost it on that fourth playoff hole, because I feel like it could have been a bit controversial with they shouldn't have been playing, it was dark. So, you know, we ended up having to come back Monday. So many people have asked me, oh, you must have been so nervous sleeping on Sunday night. And I'm like, no. Now that was my fourth night in a row kind of sleeping on the lead. So once again, I'd been practicing that each and every night. And what I also kept telling myself was, I have done all the hard work up until this point. I'm playing so good that I also have nothing to lose. I'm clearly the underdog. It's me against Imbi Park at the moment. She's a 7-time major champion. She won the Rio Olympics. I have never won a professional event up until this point. I'm talking mini tour events, LPGA events. So, you know, I really had that mentality that I'm playing great. Just keep doing what you're doing, but I also have nothing to lose. And because it was Imbi, it almost made it easier for me, where I think if it would have been a less established player, I probably would have maybe taken a backseat a little bit more. And you almost wait for the other player to make a mistake. But because of this being Imbi, I'm like, she's not going to make a mistake. I better step up and do something good. So we come back Monday morning, and you know, I've been thinking on Sunday night that, okay, my parents are here. A couple of my best friends on tour are going to stay. So I'm like, I'm counting on my hands. I'm like, oh, you know, it would probably at least be like 5 to 10 people out there in the morning supporting me. We come out. So Monday morning, we start on the 10th hole, and the fairway is just lined with people. And I just feel how they are cheering for me. Because as you know, Americans love an underdog story.
Mm-hmm.
So I really had the support of Palm Springs there, and we ended up playing 10, 17, 18. On 18, I had then I could go for that par 5. I ended up 3 putting for a par. I had about a 6-footer to win, and that was probably my only really nervous bad putting stroke the whole week. Back to 10 again, so we're on the 8th playoff hole now, and I hold about a 30-footer. I couldn't really celebrate because Imbi still was inside me. She probably had a 12 to 15 footer, and she's considered the best putter in the world. So, you know, I walk over to my golf bag. I take a sip of water. I tell myself, okay, she's going to hold this putt. We're going to go back to 17 again. And when she missed it, I could just turn to Daniel and said, we did it. We did it.
That must have been the greatest feeling. And to have Daniel along on the bag because he'd been your caddy for so many years. Does it ever get old when they announce your name on the first tee as a Chevron champion or a major champion?
Not at all. That's just the coolest thing that no one can ever take away from me.
They cannot. And you just described to me how to win a major. So, you know, why don't you go do it this year? Huh?
Exactly. And that's, you know, I think I struggled with it for a few years, which you've seen from so many other kind of first time major champions too, that, I mean, end up with a little bit of a slump the following years. And it's not that I didn't try. I still had the motivation. But expectations, that's a hard thing in golf. And, you know, once I went out and won a major, to set goals the following seasons, where it didn't sound good to just say that I wanted to go out and win an event, because that was kind of taking a step back. But saying also that I wanted to go out and win a second major felt really hard. So that was something that I was kind of battling for a few years, but I feel like I'm in a great spot now where I am kind of just reminding myself of that I have gotten this done before, which is an experience that not that many people have. And I also have started to work with a new coach and just feel like things are trending in a good direction. So yeah, I like the sound of that.
Very good. That's the great sound. But also, what you told me earlier, just getting a little better each day. I mean, you got kind of a restart button, you said, a new instructor. I think are you working with Jonathan Moore on the physical part of it or not?
I am, exactly. So yeah, I started to work with Tony Ziegler, as a swing instructor here in Orlando back in August of last year. And, you know, he's my third coach in my life. I'm not one to jump around very often. I worked with my high school coach at home, and then I had another Swedish coach for about 10 years. And I've always really believed in what we've been working on. And, I was really stubborn in not wanting to try someone else, and I think that's obviously a reason that I've gotten to where I have, because I really believed in what we worked on. But I really was kind of stuck not getting anywhere with my ball striking, and went to see Tony last year in August, and it's been fantastic. So obviously now it's easy to say, oh, I wish I would have done this earlier, but you can never live like that. It's everything happens when it does for a reason. And then, yeah, in October last year, I went back to Stillwater for about the first time in 4 years. And every time I go back there, I have the same kind of experience, which is, oh, I need to come back here more often. But unfortunately, tour life doesn't take me past Stillwater often enough. It's, I always kind of have to make a trip out of it. But I worked out with the women's team the week I was there. I joined them every morning for their workouts, and really loved what Jaymore is doing when it comes to strength and conditioning with both the men's and the women's team. So I reached out to him a couple of weeks after. We did some good testing when I was there too, actually. And I just told him, I love what you're doing. Is there any chance that you could work with me remotely and program my workouts? And that was kind of early November, and I told him that I'm going to have my longest off season that I've ever had in front of me, and I want to take advantage of this time. And we did some really good work together for, I guess it was a 14 weeks this off season. And then once the season got started, we kind of went from 5 days a week to 3 days a week. But it's been noticeable. I've always considered myself strong, but I feel the strongest that I ever have. And some of my the people kind of around me that have been around me for a long time have said that when I've come out to play this season, that I look stronger than I ever have to.
Well, you got your hard work to thank for that, but it doesn't hurt having Jay Moore around. That guy he's one of the great guys in the game of golf. I just love Jay Moore. So
Oh, me too. You couldn't find a nicer guy, and it also really helps that he knows what tour life is like.
he does. He does. He's spent a lot of time out there playing professional golf himself. So I'm looking back to when you were a 14-year-old and just really getting serious about golf. You had been a very successful skier, alpine skier. You loved the game. You were strong, but you also loved the game of golf. What would be your best piece of advice for a 14-year-old girl who wants to, it could be a Swedish girl, it could be an American girl, either way, just a young girl who wants to play college golf and then professional golf, just like you have. Best piece of advice.
I think something along the lines of what I've been talking about focusing on processes and things that's in your control, and not necessarily the results at all times. Golf will beat you up more often than not, and it's easy to kind of live and die with your results. And you can play everyone knows you can play your best golf ever, and you still might not win because someone else will play even better. So really focus on things that's in your control and the little processes each and every day, and within all areas, not just breaking it up to swing, putting, short game, but also workouts, making sure that your life off the golf course is in balance, because golf is so complex that you need all aspects in your life to be in balance, to play the best golf on the golf course. So, something along those lines. Have small process-oriented goals, that some of them that can be daily or weekly or yearly, and be able to tick those boxes. Because when you do that year after year, that's when you will reach the result-oriented goals eventually.
That's great.
Yeah.
Perfect. Well, tell me this. Do you and Daniel play golf together?
Not much, but we do probably a few times a year, but it's mostly him that whenever he is not caddying, he doesn't really want to spend more time on a golf course.
Yeah. It's funny. Some golf coaches love playing, but honestly, you're out on a golf course all the time. Sometimes you just, and if you have a wife, and you can't convince her that 5.5 hours away from her just for a golf round, it's not your job. So, yeah, he's probably ready to get off the golf course, I would imagine. So, all right, tell me about the rest of your schedule this year. I know you got a little bit of a later start to the LPGA, but what have you got left?
Yeah, so yeah, once we got started, it's really busy the rest of the year now. Kind of the next month is we actually have four events in New Jersey that kind of now in May, June, but then we're getting into pretty much back to back major championships. We're playing the Women's PGA Championship at Baltusrol in end of
Oh,
June.
what a golf course.
And then the Women's US Open will be at Pebble Beach for the first time ever, early
Oh,
July.
that's great. Wow. You're
So,
playing a lot of golf in the United States then.
yes, we are kind of between now and the end of July. It's all in the US. This will be the first time in 10 years that I have to try to qualify for the US Open. So I'm going to play that qualifier in a couple of weeks, unless I take care of qualifying in a different way, which you always can do by winning a tournament. But yeah, once we hit kind of end of July, we head over to Europe, which we have a couple of majors there, the Evian Championship and the Women's British, and a couple other regular events in between those in Europe. And then we come back to the US again, kind of end of August, September, and then head over to Asia the month of October. And then we finish up in Florida with a couple events leading up to our tour championship, which is down in Naples the week before Thanksgiving.
Wow. You still love the travel, or is travel getting tiring?
Yes and no. I do still love it, but I feel like these last few years, it's for sure getting harder. But I also been one of the players that throughout most of my career, I've been one of the players that've been playing the most. I've had plenty of seasons where I've been 30, 32 events, bouncing back and forth and playing in Europe as well. These last few years, it's been probably more just north of 20, which is a lot more comfortable number. And this year is probably somewhere in the mid 20s again. Which is it's busy enough.
Well, my final question, do you still love the game as much as you do? And before you answer, I tell my guys that enthusiasm and love for what you're doing, it always gives you a better chance to play well, always. So do you still love golf as much?
If you had asked me a couple years ago, I probably would have said no, but I feel like I found that love again. And I think a couple of reasons, but it was during COVID when we had to stop play on tour for 5 months, and I would just go out here at home in Orlando with my little kind of moon bag and a few clubs and kind of just go out and play for fun. I kind of realized that this is how I started off playing and how much I did love it, but then also just this kind of fresh motivation with getting a few new people around me with coaches, and just really seeing some good progress in my game these last few months have given me some fresh kind of motivation and enjoyment again too.
Well, that's great. Well, keep that. I know you'll get great results if you keep that and keep doing what you're doing. And just want to say thanks for spending an hour with me. You're the best player I never got to coach. How about that? So,
That's something, yeah.
I mean, I recruited you. I was supposed to coach you. It didn't happen, but I'm glad we could connect again through this podcast. And Pam and I do follow you, so keep up the good work, and we'll hopefully get to see you in the winner's circle again this year.
I hope so too. And I guess I have to say thanks for recruiting me back there in 2004 or 5. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here.
Well, I'm glad I did. So, okay, well, have a great year, play well, and thanks again, Pernilla.
Thank you.